Suavemente bésame, que quiero sentir tus labios besándome otra vez. Suavemente bésame, que quiero sentir tus labios besándome otra vez. Suave, bésame.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Brandon Wong, author of the YA novel, Gloria Benrostro Is Not My Girlfriend, from Macmillan Publishing. The book was a finalist for the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators Golden Kite Award and was named as one of the Young Adult Library Services Association's 2024 Best Fiction for Young Adults. Brandon's work includes the YA novel The Crossbow of Destiny and the upcoming graphic novel Secret of Aethria, The Inventor's Eye, due out next summer. He's worked in television as a staff writer on the Disney series The Ghost and Molly Magee and Nickelodeon's Wild Pack, and as an animation executive, with credits including the Nickelodeon shows SpongeBob SquarePants and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Brandon was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest and is back here in the Portland metropolitan area after living and working in Los Angeles for several years. Please join us for our conversation with Brandon Wong, which is already in progress. Well, Brandon, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
Thanks for having me. This is wonderful. What a dream come true. This has been a wonderful, wonderful location and a lot of wonderful studios. Thank you.
Yeah, we've had it for a long time. We're lucky because this area has been gentrified. So KBOO owns the building, but I think we would have been kicked out by a much more expensive lease by now. So it worked out. Now you're from the Portland area. You were born just across the Columbia in Vancouver, and you're of Vietnamese heritage. What's your family background, and how did your parents or maybe grandparents get to the U.S., emigrate?
Yeah, my family are refugees from the war. My father came over when he was a teenager, and they immigrated to Camas, Washington, and that's where he met my mother in high school, because he was one of a group of teenagers that immigrated from Vietnam.
And was that a kind of a tricky escape at the time? I've known several people I've worked with who barely got out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I actually only just recently learned their story about how they came over. Very typical Vietnamese fashion. I didn't learn about this growing up. It was never really a story that was told to me.
They didn't talk about it.
They didn't talk about it. It really took a long time to kind of pull those stories out of them. My father didn't know that he was even escaping when he did. I have a lot of aunts and uncles. And my grandparents at the time agreed upon that they were going to tell the older siblings that what was really happening. They were leaving the country, and they were going to not tell the younger siblings what was happening. So all my father knew, he was at the cutoff right in the middle. All my father knew was get dressed like you're going to a party, and then we're going to. And they basically he just wore what you know a nice shirt, some slacks, and he thought he was going to a dinner party. And what ended up happening was they got to an airfield, boarded a plane, and they went to the Philippines.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an escape.
To get out.
Yeah, a friend of mine who I work with got out on a very risky escape by boat.
Yeah.
And there were, of course, a lot of people on the boat trying to get out, and boy, he barely made it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are so many of those boat stories that are harrowing, terrifying tales, and it truly is a miracle that people had made it, those journeys. Yeah.
So you're first generation of your family born in America.
Yeah.
Ah. And we talked about this before we got before the mics, but living in this area, you discovered Powell's books.
Yeah.
As a kid, and you hung out in the children's list section. Was that the start, Brandon, of your love for reading and writing?
Yeah, it really was. Like I said, my weekends, there's so much more variety now than when I was a kid, but to get, you know, good Vietnamese food, you had to go into Portland to do it. You had to go, you know, travel Sandy to the pho restaurants, and you got to go over there. So a lot of my weekends that was the routine. I would go into Portland, meet up with my uncle and my cousins, and we'd have a bowl of pho, and then we'd go, hey, let's go to Powell's. Let's go hit up Powell's. And that was the thing. So I would spend a lot of my weekends was cruising the Rose Room, and there were no rules. It was kind of, you know, here's some money. pick what you want. So I spent a lot of time at Powell's.
Oh, that's great. So your family kind of encouraged you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It was, Powell's was a big place that we went to. And then every, the holidays, I was always gifted at least one book. And it usually was, my dad didn't know what,
you know,
kids read, but he always grabbed the, you know, probably a Newbery Honor, a Newbery Medalist, right? Yeah, he was, or some kind of classic book. So that's, yeah, he really fueled my love of reading just by like taking me to Powell's and also gifting me those books during the holiday season.
And you mentioned your love for R.L. Stein's books, which are Legion.
Yeah.
He's got a lot. I know my kids read them growing up.
Sure.
What you treated those books? Just the good story? A lot of them had kind of a mild horror to it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's anything mild about the ones I was reading.
Oh,
it's funny because at the time, a lot of people will ask me when they learn that I grew up reading R.L. Stein, they immediately think Goosebumps, which is a younger, middle grade series.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I skipped over that. I didn't read Goosebumps. I remember I was in a bookstore in Canada, and I remember just kind of, I went to a lot of used bookstores. Like, you know, my father would give me $5, go pick out a book. And there was a book called The Babysitter, and that was young adult. That was not for kids. I was definitely out of my age range, but I don't know why I picked it up. I just thought it was interesting, picked it up. And that was my first intro to R.L. Stein. And I couldn't get enough of those books. Spent a lot of money at Powell's buying those paperbacks, R.L. Stein. I couldn't get enough. And I would devour them. I don't know why I picked that one, but it introduced.
Oh, you weren't alone. He had quite a readership. No, it's a really entertaining writer.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned Sideways Stories by Lewis Sacker. He's famous for the novel Holes, which was also a movie. What was the appeal of the Sideways Stories? Kind of the same thing, just a very engaging plot and characters?
Yeah, actually, my first, as far as like inspirational writers, Lewis Sacker was my favorite, absolute favorite author when I was a kid. I remember I picked up a book of his called Lesser Known, right? He's known for Holes. He's known for Sideways Stories.
Which I think were award winners too. Sure. Holes certainly was.
Holes was definitely one of those books that I got for the holidays, right? That's one of the big ones. And I love that. I have a tattered copy still. The pages hanging off the spine in my collection. I still have that copy. But the book that really brought me into, inspired a lot of my writing was a story called There's a Boy in the Girl's Bathroom.
I don't know that one.
And I picked it up just on almost like a dare. A friend of mine were in the library, were looking at it, and we thought it was a funny title. And he kind of dared me. I dare you to get that book. Right? It sounds like it sounds like a risky title, right? It's an eye-catching title. And I grabbed it, and it was a story that was the first book to make me cry.
Wow.
It sounds like it was a funny story. And that's kind of what I like about Lewis Sacker so much is that he can tell these stories that are both very, very funny, very relatable. And then like, will kind of like snipe you a little bit with that emotional punch. And I remember I finished that story. I couldn't get enough of it. And I finished that story. And I remember I finished it on the morning before school and I was crying and I couldn't stop myself from crying. I was so overwhelmed. And my mother actually called the school and was like, he's not sick. There's no fever. She's really upset. I'm going to keep him home today.
But they were okay with it. Oh, is he reading Lewis Sacker again?
Yeah. That was the first one that got me. Yeah. I just think he has a blend and I tend to gravitate towards stories that are like that have that perfect balance of humor and also that sneaks in that emotional punch.
Hey, you picked that up in the book in Gloria Benrostro.
Exactly. Yeah, that's absolutely. I hope that I hit that mark of doing that.
Yeah, I had a book like that when I was in grade school. I got a Robert Heinlein book out of the library. It would be considered a YA novel now. It was called Half Spacesuit, Will Travel. I think at the time it was just called juvenile literature.
Sure.
Yeah, they didn't think too much of young readers. And that got me reading things other than comic books, so it was very influential. In the acknowledgments, talking about inspired by books, you mentioned your fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Stone.
Yeah.
She gave you a book, Brandon, that changed your life. And she also predicted very kindly that you'd see your name in light someday.
Yeah, Mrs. Stone was, she was my fourth and fifth grade teacher. And she was probably my favorite. I had a lot of wonderful teachers, but she was, she was wonderful. She was a black woman who was just introduced me to a lot of progressive, radical thoughts that I didn't know existed. I remember at my school, one of the big ones was that there was you weren't allowed to wear hats, and we were all wanted to wear hats in school. Right? I don't think they're allowed to even do that. Even these days, people make you take off your hats out of respect when you're indoors. But she said, if you guys really, truly feel strongly about this, make a case. Go and organize, gather, go talk to the principal.
What a great lesson.
Put a, you know, that was one of my first lessons about
how did it turn out? Did you get the hat rule overturned?
You know, I think that I don't think it got completely overturned, but I think it was like one day a week you're allowed to do that.
A hat day.
So we had a hat day. We got a hat day. I don't know if they still do that. I would have actually, I'm very curious if that elementary school still does that. But yeah, she was always very much looking out for us. And I remember there was a book that there weren't a lot of Vietnamese characters in books at that time. And there was one where she kind of pulled me aside and said, I'm pretty sure this is can you tell me, is this a Vietnamese name? And I said, whoa, you're right. That is a Vietnamese name. That's the main character of the story. And she said, I think, go ahead, here, read it.
Do you remember the book?
It was, I don't remember the author's name, but the book was called Hello, My Name is Scrambled Eggs. I don't know if it's any good, but I remember I was completely flabbergasted. I could not believe that there was a book that
it means so much to really get represented in the art that you're watching, reading.
Yeah, sure.
Listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in school, I read you wrote and illustrated your own books, which you sold to neighbors, so very enterprising. So you caught the writing bug at a young age. Do you remember some of those early stories? Were they influenced by Lewis Sacker, R.L. Stein?
Yeah, I did a lot of I remember when our family first got a family computer, a PC. That was it. I was locked in. I was going to – my parents had to kick me out of the house and be like, you need to go out – one, you need to stop reading till noon, and you need to go out and breathe some fresh air because you're on the computer. Either if you're not reading, you're writing, and I still suffer from that today, actually. But that's what I was doing. I was writing stories. I remember my first I entered a contest in school, and I won based off a story that was – it was basically a ripoff of Ghostbusters, the movie Ghostbusters. But I was like, what if we did Ghostbusters but we had it star children instead of, you know – 40-year-old men.
What a great idea.
So I had it was a story about me and my friends that were going around trying to solve ghost mysteries. And I was just like, I did like eight of them, and I did like my own like awards. And I said, okay, like, what's the best story that's going to win this year of my own?
Uh-huh. Yeah, but you still got recognized by people other than you. I mean, winning the awards in the school.
Yeah, I did a lot. That was one. And I did a lot of, in very Lewis Sacker fashion, kind of observing kids and taking the funny stories that just for my own life and for my kids, and I would make that into a book. I experimented with a lot of different kind of things.
Now, you went to the University of Washington. You graduated with a degree in sociology, and you moved to Los Angeles. Was the goal there, Brandon, to get into television and writing for TV?
Yeah, I always wanted to work in some kind of children's media. I wasn't sure if it was going to be film or television. Actually, my first internship before I made the move was actually at Leica.
Oh, here, yes.
Yeah, in Portland, right when Will Vinton Studios was, they had changed it over to Leica.
Right. Will Vinton, he kind of invented claymation.
Right.
Or certainly popularized it. And then his studio was bought out by Phil Knight, and he gave his son control over it. So
one of my first jobs was actually scraping the logo off the glass. It was that new. So that was my first internship. And I was like, okay, I always loved animation. So I thought maybe I would work in animation. So, but yeah, the goal moving to Los Angeles, I was going to try to work in children's television or film. And I ended up, doing that. I ended up working in children's animation.
I read you were an assistant first at Nickelodeon Animation Studios, and Nickelodeon, perfect place. I mean, there's a lot of kids' cartoons. How'd you get your foot in the door and work your way up, what you did later, to animation executive?
Yeah, look, Nickelodeon was the dream job. I did a few interviews there to try to get in my foot. I mean, I think at one point, whenever you enter a studio at Nickelodeon, you have to sign in and have a guest sign in as a guest, and they give you a little guest badge. And I had gone in for so many interviews, I would tape them to my wall. I had at least 8 or 9 because I could not quite nail that final interview. I'd be brought in for the first interview, be brought in for the second interview, and I couldn't get that interview. So I had about 9 different stickers at one point taped to my wall, being like, I'm going to get in here. It ended up being that I had interviewed with a couple of executives who were looking for an assistant, and they said, we're network executives, we're creative executives. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that is, but I need a job and I have some student loans I got to pay off. So
what is it? What was the role of a creative executive?
So creative executive, you are overseeing the shows that are in production. You have your, right? You have your productions that are actually making the shows, right? Writing, drawing, all the stuff that goes into production. But then you have to have someone on the network side that kind of oversees the production that helps it.
Like budget and...
Yeah, right. You're keeping things moving. You're doing all the other stuff that's happening. You're kind of this... You're the conduit between all the other stuff. Consumer products.
Wow.
You're communicating to the press team. You're an expert at the show, so you can help... While the show does... The production focuses on making the show, you have someone that's like a point person that can like help facilitate and handle everything else. So... You're reading scripts, you're reading, looking at storyboards, and you're giving notes on that kind of stuff. You're there at every step of the way. And you're kind of, I say, your role, I always say, is that you're the show's biggest champion.
And then you became a staff writer for several shows, including SpongeBob SquarePants. Were you a staff writer for
that? I was not a staff writer on that show. Okay. No, that would have been very sweet. No, I was an executive on that show. So, uh-huh. So my SpongeBob days, that was before I transitioned to writing. I was a staff writer on two shows, one for Disney called The Ghost and Molly McGee.
Yes, I know that one.
And then I was my next staff gig was I was a writer on the Nickelodeon show called Wild Pack.
And how did you transition from creative executive to a staff writer? It's yeah. Probably your first love, huh?
Yeah. Well, I was very scared to, I always wanted to write, but it was very hard to admit that I wanted to do that. You know, when I had first moved to LA, it was during the writer's strike or during a recession. I think the writer's strike was going on. So like I said, I had student loans to pay off. I had to live in Los Angeles coming out of as a fresh graduate, not knowing really anyone. So I was like, I need to just make money. So, I was very scared to take on a write to admit I wanted to write and to pursue that path because it's a very hard gig.
Very competitive too.
Extremely competitive and not stable. And you're constantly having to jump to, show to show to show. So I was like, okay, I'm going to put that behind. I'm not going to admit it. I don't want to admit that I want to do this. But when I was an executive, I was an executive on a show called The Legend of Korra. And I was writing books at that time. So I was an executive by day, would work my day job. At night, I'd come home, and then I'd write and work.
You do your own writing.
I would work on my own manuscripts, uh-huh. Right? That's right. So I became, I had a nice rapport with the two showrunners of The Legend of Korra, Mike DiMartino and Brian Konietzko. And I think we just got along very well. I think they liked how I thought about story when we would talk notes in the room and things like that. So when they had an opportunity to do a live action adaptation of their show, Avatar: The Last Airbender, they had asked me, they took me out for dinner and they said,
"Wow, I know that movie. That's great."
Yeah, they had asked me. They said, "Hey, we know that you're writing children's books. Do you want to be a writer? Have you thought about writing for television?" And I said, "Well, not seriously." And they said, "Why don't you come with us? You know the property. As our executive, you know the property
right.
more than anyone else. Why don't you come with us? Let's come with us in the room and help us develop this show." So I said, okay, let's do it. So I'm going to control alt delete my career. I'm going to start over, make this very terrifying jump to, after being an executive for 10 years, I'm going to make the jump and do writing. So those guys were very, very good to me and they gave me a shot.
You must have learned a lot about story and characters and kind of a structure.
Yeah, of course.
Narrative structure.
Yeah, of course. Especially, being an executive, you're reading, as I mentioned, you're reading everything from from a premise to an outline to a script. You're reading how and learning, and you can't give notes on those things unless
you know
it.
So you kind of learn what works.
Yeah.
What the audience appreciates and what is kind of dull to them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think you're learning about pacing. You're learning about, a three-act structure. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Now, another part of your bio, this is a slight digression. It caught my eye when you curated a dating blog. I was wondering, what was the blog and how did it work in those days before apps, I think, like Match.com, eHarmony, Tinder, OkCupid?
Yeah, those were new. So I actually, at the time, I had started this blog when I was in my early 20s. I had just gotten broken up with my long-term high school sweetheart. And I was really having a hard time trying to sort my feelings out. And what do I do? There's no advice out there for guys like me. Like, all these self-help books are directed or geared, written by women for women. I was like, what about someone for a guy, for someone, like, you know. So I was really spiraling, and I remember I had some friends that were like, hey, I can't talk to you about this breakup anymore. You got to find another outlet. have you heard about blogs? And blogs were, at that time, they were very popular.
Right.
Like online diaries. So I said, okay, maybe this is a way I can maybe help myself find a therapeutic way through writing, but also it might help someone else that's like me that, you know, just got their heart broken and need to find a, there's a path to salvation. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. So I it could be fun. I was like, I'll write something that's like a self-deprecating kind of dating, of my dating experiences. So that was how, yeah, I started this, and it kind of snowballed and it became, you know, semi-popular, I guess, in the blog world.
And yeah. You met your wife through
that's
this blog?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow, what a happy ending. Yeah, it does sound like a Hallmark movie, doesn't it?
How am I not making money off this?
yeah, but you did a lot better.
yeah. She had her own blog. Back then, it seemed like everyone or anyone in your 20s, 20-somethings had some blog. Of their
own, now right? It's Substack.
Right.
Which I think is still a blog. I got to just give it a different name.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was, she was a reader. So she used to leave comments on the posts that I would do. And then I thought her comments were really funny. So then of course I would reciprocate, read her blog, read her entries, leave comments on her blog and try to get her attention by being just as funny as her. I don't know if I succeeded. those comments turned into emails, turned into text messages, turned into, when can I see you?
Yeah. Wow. What a wonderful story. Now let's get into the story of the book. Gloria Benrostrow Is Not My Girlfriend. Brandon, I think you pitched the idea back in 2019. Was the manuscript finished by then, or you just kind of had the germ of the idea?
Yeah, I actually sold Gloria in a very unconventional way, right? Typically, especially for first time authors.
Yes, you have to have a completed manuscript, go through an agent or know somebody to publish or a good editor.
I had an agent. I had another agent. I still do. A wonderful agent, Alyssa Jeanette. She actually was a reader of my blog first before she was an agent.
And that blog opened a lot of doors.
It truly did. Truly did. I owe a lot to that blog, that little blog that could. She and I, she had signed me as her client, and we were trying to sell one project. We couldn't quite do it at the time, but then she had asked me to do a general with an editor over at Macmillan, and it was just a general meeting. And I was asking Trisha, who was the editor on Gloria, what are you looking for at the time? What kind of books are you, what kind of stories are you trying to buy? And she said, you know, she kind of went through her list of, oh, I'm looking for this, I'm looking for this. And then she said, I'm looking for books that address or tackle toxic masculinity. And a light bulb went in my head. And I said, I've actually been toying with an idea. I've never put pen to paper, but I think I have something. So I kind of verbally pitched to her this idea. And she said, and I remember this, this is a fun little fact. I was actually had this call. I had forgotten about this call that was scheduled. And I was happened to be at the Los Angeles Zoo with my family. So I had to find a quiet place to do this call with this very important call with this editor. And we're finding like the bird section because I figured it's probably gonna be the least populated place. And so I'm doing this call while these birds are squawking in the background. Like, sorry about that. Sorry. So I had to pitch this over the squawk of birds. But the verbal pitch that I had was enough for her to ask for a treatment with the first, give me an outline, a rough outline on the first 50 pages.
Wow.
And let's go from there. And I did. And that's how I sold the project based off the outline in the first 50 pages. I didn't have a manuscript finished at that time.
Boy, that's what a great story, but a lot of pressure, huh? To kind of finish it and still make sure that they're happy with it, huh?
I mean, nothing inspires you more than a deadline.
That's for sure. I wouldn't get anything done without a deadline. Now, the novel was named one of Young Adult Library Services Association's, YALSA for short, 2024 Best Fiction for Young Adults. On the YALSA website, they peg the YA audience as ages 12 to 18. Is that the sweet spot for your reading audience?
Yeah, I do love that. I mean, I also write middle grade as well. So I do like to even go a little bit younger than that too. But I do love, you know, I love writing for the younger audience, right? Like 6 to 11. That's a fun spot for me to write. But yeah, I also love writing for teenagers as well. Keeps things fresh, you know, to be able to bounce back and forth between middle grade and young adult.
Are there certain guidelines you have to follow? Restrictions maybe on vocabulary, sentence length, even subject matter?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. Language, subject matter too, right? You're not going to have you can't talk about sex, drugs, your characters in a middle grade. For young adult, they're typically, they're teenagers that are in high school dealing with high school problems and high school issues.
Of course, just because a book is labeled YA and written for a YA audience, it doesn't mean older adults can't enjoy them. I think the Harry Potter books are a good example of that. And a book like Gloria Benrostro about high school kids and what they go through, peer pressure, toxic masculinity, the longing to be one of the cool kids and feelings of young love, is something most of us older adults have experienced and remember well. What did you hear from older readers of the book? Because I certainly identified with a lot of it. I had no trouble enjoying the book.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think it really, one of the reasons why I'm a big reader of young adult and middle grade books that are, I'm not the target range for that, but I enjoy reading them for those exact reasons. It takes me back. I think that one of my favorite reasons for writing for that age, those age groups, is because I don't think that you feel as strongly about things unless you're that age. And so
that's for sure.
It's easier to tap into that stuff and at least for me, to kind of tap into that and like be able to write really like intense feeling stories and feel those feelings again and to really tap into it, to be able to craft a story. So I think that's why, I think the people that have gravitated toward Gloria, it's for that reason. I think, they can remember what it's like to feel those feelings. What's it like to feel that intense feeling of your first crush and how devastating it can be, but how exciting it can be at the same time.
Those don't go away. And I'm way beyond high school. I think one really good example is Gary, the main character, Gary Vaugh, sometimes overwhelming feelings for Gloria Benrostro in the face of his insecurities. He thinks he's not good enough for her. And I thought this passage from the book puts it so well. Brandon, I wonder if you would read it for us and maybe set it up a little first as you feel it needs.
Sure. Yeah. So Gary discovers that Gloria is in the business of doing alterations and making tamales and selling them in her neighborhood. So this is the first time he has gone to her house and has offered to help her make tamales for the first time. A door slam jolted us, followed by more yelling leaking through the walls. I rounded the island to the window and cranked the radio up loud enough so Elvis would drown them out, then returned to my station and held up the bag of masa. "I think I'm finished with my homework here," Gloria smiled. "I'll be the judge of that." She peeked over and shook her head. "Nah, you're not done yet. Not even close. You can't waste anything. There's way more masa. You have to dig deep. Get back in there." Before I could register what was happening, Gloria had plunged her hand into the bag, and that was when I felt them. Her fingers touching mine, her warmth cut through the cold dough. Her fingertips trickled over my knuckles as if in slow motion. This wasn't a gaze or a brushing. This was a full-on touch. The kind of touch that sucked all the oxygen out of the room. The kind that made you promise to God that you'd never indulge in another sin if it meant getting 10 more seconds. I had to keep reminding myself that it would be rude for me to race out of the kitchen and call Preston. No one would believe me anyway. I know I wouldn't. Gloria's hands dipped into the bag. Through the chill of masa, I felt her fingers fumble as they grazed my own. Her thumb brushed against my palm, sending chills up my arm. The air caught in my throat. Instead of reeling back in embarrassment, she allowed her hand to remain, touching my own. It may have been a fraction of a nanosecond, but damn it, it counted. "You want to try one?" Gloria said before finally reeling in her grip. "You have to at least know what you're making. Have you ever had tamales?" I don't think so. No, probably not. I mean, not to my collection." Ugh, I hated myself. I wasn't even formulating words. My brain was short-circuiting.
Ah, that's so well written. And definitely you were ahead of a guy that age, yeah. Without a doubt.
I'm probably still like that, too.
Maybe we all are to a certain point. Now, another theme of the book I kind of identify with from my high school days is the gulf between the well-off students, the cool kids like Jordan Tallender in the book, and the lower middle class ones like Gary and his friend Preston, who you just mentioned in that passage. You lived in LA for a while. I went to junior high and high school there. So I went to a school called Hamilton High School, which had students coming from two junior highs. One was Palms Junior High in Cheviot Hills, which was relatively affluent and predominantly white. And my side of the tracks, the east side of Robertson, where we came from, Pastor Junior High, which is about 70% black and not so well off. In fact, the current mayor of L.A., Karen Bass, was my classmate at both Pasteur and Hamilton. Yeah. So you have the issue of class in the book, which I think many people could identify with at any age.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, there's a lot of Los Angeles. There's a lot of my own childhood growing up in the Northwest in this book, but there is a lot of Los Angeles, especially thinking about East Side versus West Side, right? The richer, more...
Yeah, like, and here was just Robertson Boulevard was the track separating us.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in the book, you know, Gary, the neighborhood he's in is kind of was modeled after kind of like the east side of LA, the one that, you know, the places that aren't quite, you know, kept up, right? You have like, you know, there's some places with like overgrown, his neighbor has some yards that have like overgrown weeds, chain link fences, little empty plastic liquor bottles that are dotting the lawn, right? Versus like you go to some place over like on the fancier east side and you have like the beach views, the beach communities, right? Very, very different. So in the book, yeah, Gary actually ends up mentioning that he only is he only goes to Gloria School because of a boundary exception. So,
and he has, you say, a Viet Mom who fought like hell to
don't get in the way of a Vietnamese mom and her son's education, right? Yeah, to fight for that boundary exception, make sure he's going to the, you can't see my quotes here, but right, the good school.
Now, I love this passage from the book, which gives a sense of how people who are not that well off think. At one point, Gary sneaks in with Gloria to this very ritzy country club. And he's in the locker room changing into a swimsuit and sees all these free toiletries for the members. There's razors, shave cream, lotions, deodorant even. And he thinks, why was it that the people who could easily afford this stuff got it for free? The world didn't make sense. I've thought this many times myself.
I base that off of the very first time I ever stepped into an athletic club, which I didn't know existed for so long. I didn't know what those were. Stepping in and seeing all this free stuff, and I was so confused. I was like, is this free? What's happening here? Why is this out for display? Do I have to pay someone? Where's the cash register? And they're like, no, you don't have to pay. This is all free. I was like, why is it that – exactly what Gary said. Why is it that all the people that can afford a sports club membership get all the free stuff?
But, of course, the sports club membership's a lot higher than the other gym memberships. So,
right.
So maybe it's included in the price of admission. Now, in a Seattle Times interview, you said the book got its start when you went back to some old notes you kept in grade school and middle school. So this is even before the pitch, I think. And you were inspired by a real-life model for the title character, Gloria Benrostro, who was a friend of yours, who was also the most popular girl in school?
Yeah, she was a friend of mine that was a girl that lived in my neighborhood. And we ended up being classmates from elementary school and middle school and a little bit of high school. And she was, yeah, I had based Gloria off just at least my perception of her when I was the kid. She was, you know, everyone in the book, you'll notice that like they always, for a long time, they say Gloria Benrostro. They just say first name and last name. It's the girl that you have to say their full name. Like they're on this pedestal. I mean, I don't know if you can think back to, can you think of like who your Gloria Benrostro was in your school?
There was one in high school. Yeah.
Right.
Jan Glick.
Okay. See,
I always referred to as Jan Glick. Yeah.
See, everyone says it.
But I didn't have a chance. Gary did a lot better with Gloria than I.
But that's the thing. Everyone, almost any single time you ask someone what that is, they can say the full, it's always the full first, full name, first and last name, first and last name, first and last name. Yeah. So I had gone through these notes and it was really, I kept all these notes that we exchanged back and forth, but with notes, I'm not seeing what I wrote to her. I'm always putting together the pieces of what she wrote to me. I only have the notes I kept that she wrote to me. So, it was just really interesting to see some of these, the transition about, you know, she was this person that we kind of idolized and kept at a distance, but she was a friend of mine because I knew her in the neighborhood, but you know, you weren't ever really quite sure, like, because we all
perception versus reality.
Absolutely. And we were always like stunned by how, you know, everyone would always talk, oh, she's so beautiful. Oh, she's so beautiful. But you never like really quite get close. Why would she ever want to hang out with us? Right. So you had this perception of this mystery that she was shrouded in mystery. And
just like Gloria, she's not so happy when people call her beautiful because she wants to be known for her better qualities, or she thinks they're better qualities.
Yeah, there's a line I took actually from my sister-in-law, who was probably the Gloria Ben Roaster from when she was. But I remember I stole a line that she had said once where she was like, I wish I never heard the words, you are beautiful, ever again, because that's always the first thing that people would say. They wouldn't ever even, and they would rarely go deeper than that, right? It's always just, every single time it's just about how pretty they are, how what their looks are. And she's like, I'm more than that. And but no one ever takes the time, and no one ever wants to get close because they're so intimidated by that, by that beauty. So yeah, but the notes were, that was really insightful to see like how our friendship kind of evolved. The original pitch for Gloria actually started off, it was supposed to be their friendship starting off in elementary school and going, tracking to middle school and going to high school.
Oh, so kind of a longer novel.
It was going to be longer.
Time.
And then
this is over one summer.
And then my editor had said, she made, of course, made the right move, was that, that's too ambitious. It's like, okay, let's do that. And that's.
But you make it clear their history goes back a few years.
Right.
Before high school.
Right.
Now, in a nod to your teacher, Mrs. Stone, from fourth and fifth grade, you said there were not a lot of YA novels with teen Vietnamese protagonists. And this book is for other Vietnamese kids to see themselves represented, which was very important for you. You added something that doesn't deal with Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So that's almost a way of stereotyping Vietnamese characters in fiction.
There's just a lot of like a lot of them are, you know, stories about Vietnam War or post Vietnam War. Or there's always some mention of Vietnam War, and I don't think there's a single mention of that in this book.
No.
Right. So, and that's what I wanted. I was like, we can just be characters without
having. We could be humans without this complicated history all the time. You know, their own personal history.
I mean, that wasn't my experience. I didn't grow up, the effects of my father was, of course, a refugee from the war. But like, other than that, that wasn't my experience as a teenager in high school.
And not Gary's experience in the book at all.
Absolutely.
Now, were you one of the few Vietnamese students in school, or was there a community of Vietnamese
kids
that you played with? And
no, not really. I mean, my school was, I don't know the percentages, but mostly white. It was, again, an affluent school, mostly white.
Was there any kind of discrimination against you as a Vietnamese student? Since they were all kind of white kids from very different cultures.
Yeah. You know, I always love that question because I think it's not consciously. And when I think back about it, I'm like, maybe there was something I didn't quite recognize. I wasn't kind of observant about. I think Gary mentions that too. He's like, I didn't actually there was no one bullying me or shoving me into lockers or calling me out for being Vietnamese. But he says like, it's almost, he's invisible. In fact, no one's picking on him. No one's calling him out because no one even knows he exists. is that worse? I don't know.
And of course, that's what his friend Preston and Gary are both trying to overcome. That's a big part of the plot. You said the other thing I wanted to highlight is you can make pretty bad mistakes and address them. I, meaning you, Brandon, made a lot of mistakes as a teenager, and I wish I had a book to show me there's a healthy way to deal with this. And I was curious, what were those mistakes?
Yeah, I think, you know.
You didn't rob a bank or anything.
Well, I'm not going to admit that now.
Oh, no.
What's the statute of limitations on bank robbery?
Robbing a bank.
I just think that, you know, I made a lot of mistakes that typical teenage boys do. I mean, everyone, right? Everyone makes mistakes in high school. Everyone has done something like that. But, you know, regarding teenage boys and romantic relationships, you know, it's become a more of a topic these days about how to deal with rejection and what does that mean? Why, you know, there's a lot of discussions right now about, you know, how do I get girls to like me? Why aren't girls, you know, and there's a lot of problems that are coming with that. But like I said, there was just, I turned to books a lot to find answers to things that I'm going through with myself, which a lot of people do, but there was nothing like that when I was a kid, you know? So I would get like unrequited love, you know, I'd have a crush on someone and she didn't like me and I'd, you know, you fall into that trap of being like, of course, I'm the nice guy. I didn't, this is the reason why. It's, you know, it's them, not me, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Or it's the other way around where you're,
you know, I'm not good enough.
It's because I'm Vietnamese. I'm 5'2". No, of course, you don't like a short Vietnamese man. I'm doomed forever. You know, so you had this self-loathing almost. So you bounce back and forth kind of stuff. And there was just no literature about that that was accessible. And I was like, if I would have had a book like this, I think it would have at least been like, hey, there's someone, you're not alone in feeling this way. You know, there's a healthy way to kind of like, you're your feelings that you're having about this complicated feelings with romance and crushes and the things that come with that, they're all things that are universal that you're not alone in feeling.
Oh, that's for sure.
But there's a way to go about it that's healthy.
Yes.
And there's another way. And I just, you know, I think that's the beauty of kind of like books aimed for children, is that they can show you a different way, at least model it in a story form.
You also have kind of a theme where you have Gloria asking Gary if he believes in second chances. She's talking about her dad, and he had an affair. That's why the parents are separated. But she always has hope for a second chance where they'll reconcile. But it has a wider meaning from what you just said, I think, Brandon, and maybe for readers as well.
That's my favorite line in the book, actually.
Uh-huh.
For that reason.
It resonated with me, too.
Oh, thanks. That's the almost the point of the book. You know, Gary gets into this. The whole book launches off because he agrees to partake in a pretty slimy thing to do, which is
right.
He has to steal something from this girl to get accepted into this exclusive club.
Who's become one of his best friends.
Right. And it was a very delicate balance, actually, when I had first submitted some early drafts, because my editor and her team were very nervous, because they're like, our reader's going to accept this protagonist and love him when right off the bat, he's making a terrible decision. And I was like,
yes, but you did the balance just right.
I think it took a lot of.
Yeah, we were all rooting for him and hoping he would decide not to steal.
Yeah. I hope I did okay. I know there were a few people that I didn't, you know, the people that detractors that didn't like the book that were, didn't think that still, I don't think got on board with Gary. But, you know, I think that I was trying to be true to the teenage experience about like, our brains aren't fully developed yet when we're that age. We are making really dumb mistakes and making poor choices all the time. And it's like, what do we do from there?
And then he definitely hopes that there are second chances for him.
Right. So then he's hoping that so it's like, you know, what is it when we make a mistake? How are we redeemable? What does it mean to find a way back? Like, you know, you're going to have fights with your friends and things like that. Like, can we come back? Yeah. That's the question of the book. Do people get second chances? Do we believe in second chances?
Right. And Gary and Gloria, they're from far different backgrounds, but they have at least one thing in common, that's absent fathers. In Gary's case, he never knew his dad, who doesn't appear in the book. The reader doesn't know much about him other than he gambled away all the family's money. And that's also true for his best friend, Preston, who's Vietnamese and being raised by a single mom. Now, for Gloria, her Latina mom and her white dad are separated. The dad, as we mentioned, had an affair. It's something they continually argue about, the couple. So these two characters both have that hole in their lives, but the saving grace is they both have very strong and loving mothers.
Yeah, I just, you know, I admire a lot of the strength of the single Vietnamese mother. I mean, Vietnamese moms always have, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is in the Vietnamese mom experience, but they're always like so resilient and tough. And they, especially the single Vietnamese mother, they are just such hard workers. They work so hard to, you know, put food on the table. And
I think that's true with the single Latina mother too.
Absolutely. And I think that they bought, you know, absolutely. And you can see there's so many instances of Gloria when her mom is doing this business, she needs her daughter's help. They're both working themselves to the point of exhaustion. Yeah, absolutely. It was an admirable. I've always admired that, and so I think that was like, oh, let's have a story where that kind of show. I mean, it's not the spotlight, but it's, you know, let's put something on that where they.
It's an important part of the story.
Yeah.
You know that they've got a good home to grow up in with good values, and that shows.
Right. Yeah.
Now Jordan Tellender, we mentioned. One of the rich kids from the better part side of town, the wealthier side, forms a small club for the cool kids, which he calls the Roosters. That's after a mispronunciation of Gloria's last name, Gwen Rooster instead of Rostro.
Mm-hmm.
Gary and his friend Preston would do almost anything to become a member, so they're not invisible, like you mentioned. They objectify the women in school and can't really see them as real people like them, and even Gary's guilty of this. He sees Gloria as an almost goddess, beautiful, perfect in every way. But like you did with your friend, who is inspired a lot of the book, he can see the real Gloria when he learns more about her. And there's this quote, Gloria wasn't some celestial being from another planet. She was a goofy, silly teenager trying to figure it all out, just like the rest of us. A lesson of great value. And I don't think it's limited to just young adults.
Yeah, I think it's... you get to know someone. You're experiencing the tandem bike that they are forced to ride together is a symbol of when you're forced to kind of be with someone in proximity and you are learning about them, then it's going to, all these preconceived notions are going to melt or transform into a bit deeper understanding of who they are.
Right.
And that's why I picked tandem bicycle as like a symbol for this book. And
it's on the cover.
It's on the cover. and it's like a funny, not to mention it's such a funny visual to see two teenagers being forced to ride it. When's the last time you saw a tandem bike out in the wild?
It's also not in the best condition. It was his mom's, Gary's right. mom's, and he right. kind of refurbished a little. Gloria's bike broke, so she made Gary go out with her on her deliveries.
Yeah.
For the tailoring and the tamales.
Yeah. It was a way to force the characters to stay together, right? And they can't separate themselves from somebody. They're forced into this situation together. But that's literally just, you're spending all this time with someone. You're going to learn about them. You're going to learn that, and you're going to break apart that, she's a teenager. Just like he is. She's having problems. It's like, she doesn't know everything. She doesn't know the answer. She doesn't have all the answers, and she makes mistakes of her own in this.
Right. Yeah, definitely. But she's still a pretty good person. Yeah. So we also contrast in the book, and I think that's something that you're getting at in the title here. It contrasts romantic love and maybe this kind of young, a crush love with a love we feel for a good friend. And sometimes that friend love is more significant and lasting mm-hmm. than the romantic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what Gary learns with Gloria.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, the original title of this book,
Yes, this is not a love story.
That's right.
So why did you change that?
Because it is. the title just wasn't
very descriptive.
Was also just not accurate, right? Uh-huh.
That's right. Yes. It's just the two different,
it's a different
connotations
kind
of love.
It's a different kind of love. Uh-huh. And actually, I can't remember who over at FSG thought of this tagline, but they put it on the top of this paperback edition of the book.
Oh, yes.
And it says, "Not all love stories end in romance." And
kind of a spoiler right on the cover.
Well, the title also gives it away too, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to end up together.
I was still hoping throughout the whole thing, even though I kind of knew.
Yeah, but that's the thing is that Gary, and this is a spoiler, but when Gary confesses his feelings and Gloria says, "I just don't have the same romantic feelings you do," you kind of he has a decision to make. And it's either, I can either pout about this and kind of stew in my own feelings and potentially lose one of the greatest relationships I've ever had because I can't get over this. He makes the right decision in the end, but you're right. Like that friendship is almost stronger and potentially lasts longer than this romance. What he thought would be this romantic
right.
relationship.
I think he comes to that realization. Right. I got that idea.
Yeah.
Now, Gloria Benrostro is not my girlfriend. This is not a love story. It's a realistic situation with real people as characters. And your second book, Brandon, published in August 2024, so a year ago last summer, was the YA fantasy novel, The Crossbow of Destiny. And you have a graphic novel coming out next year, The Secret of Athria, mm-hmm. The Inventor's Eye, which is YA fantasy sci-fi?
That's probably a little bit younger, probably more at middle grade.
Oh, middle grade, okay. Yeah. So I was getting at that this book, in light of your other work and your work in TV animation, is the lone example of realism. Why the detour to realism and then the return to fantasy with these succeeding books?
Well, Ken, I'm going to give you a little writer's tip that you go where the money is. So I love writing for both. Honestly, I think I just took the other two books were opportunities that I just took. I like to give myself a challenge. So I don't, if there's an opportunity that comes up,
you're not going to stick with one genre.
Writing in a genre that I'm comfortable right. with, like, hey, like I would love to take it. The Crossbow of Destiny was one where Scholastic had came to me asking me to kind of think about a fantasy book for a fantasy book in that grade. So that's kind of the route I went for The Secret of Athria. That was the very first book I tried to sell with that got me signed with my agent that I couldn't sell at first. I ended up selling it later.
And that will be a series
as
too,
a graphic
right?
novel. Yeah, hopefully. We'll see. I mean, we have the first one out, but we'll see if there's a series planned for it. But yeah, I had first started off as a middle grade and then, But yeah, I'm not beholden to one genre or the other. I think the opportunity just came up. Like I said, the Gloria wasn't a story I had written before. It was only by chance, by this phone call with my editor.
What they were looking for. She was looking for a story on toxic masculinity. Yeah.
I could have done a toxic masculinity story geared for middle grade, an audience, but it made more sense to me to write one for teenagers.
There's a nod to Shakespeare in the book. Gloria becomes good friends with Gary and wants him to help her run lines from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night because she wants to audition when school starts up again, when they're juniors after the summer ends. And she tries to get Gary to understand Shakespeare. He's reluctant, as I am. It's difficult, really, the language and all that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, is this a nod to the middle grade audience, maybe an assist to English teachers like Mrs. Stone was? like Gloria, they're trying to get their students to appreciate Shakespeare, this great writer.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually have – Shakespeare has – it's the same way. Shakespeare was so hard for me to digest. Even now, I have to ask a friend or – I definitely asked a friend when I was writing about his experience with Twelfth Night to kind of get this part in there. Yeah, it's – I remember it was hard to digest the language and things like that, but I just like the stories and characters still. Like, they're so – obviously, we've seen it so many times. We all love the Bard in the end. But it was – I just like the story of Twelfth Night of – the parallel was so perfect about the fool being a fool.
And Gary sympathizes with that character. It's Malvolio in the play. Malvolio is a servant to Olivia, which is the part Gloria is trying out for. He falls in love with her and he's mocked and tormented for it. Some bad practical jokes on him. He's not very likable, though, and somewhat of a pompous fool. But Gary views him in a different light. At one point he says, "I flipped where I'd left off of reading Twelfth Night. It was the part of Twelfth Night where everyone laughed at Malvolio's humiliation, all because he loved." So he sees him a little differently than some other playgoers or readers might.
Yeah, I think it's just cutting too close to the bone. Gary's own experience, I mean, he's seeing himself like, oh, the parallels are just too close. Right? He's like, oh, he loves this, and everyone thinks it's so foolish for him to be in this position of loving that he sees himself, right? He sees himself as the fool. That's why he can't get through that scene.
Right. But that's how he identifies with it. That's how he kind of comes to Shakespeare.
Right.
Which I think a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Where they can see themselves in a character or they can understand a little bit more because his characterizations are so good and they're complex. They're not all good or all bad.
Right. Right.
Now, there are several mentions of food in the book, which you use really well. Gloria and her mom make tamales to sell. Gary's a fan of his mom's Vietnamese cooking, especially cha lua sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
You can correct my
No, that's perfect. Okay. Actually, that was a very great pronunciation.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, we went before we got on the mic, I asked if I could remember them all. Can chua?
Can chua.
Can chua.
Mm-hmm.
And chie?
Cha.
Cha. Mm-hmm. Okay, which is a dessert pudding. So food is a way to further define the characters and their ethnic backgrounds. Gloria as Latin American and Gary as Vietnamese American. And it works. You know, I think a lot of us are defined through our tastes in food and our families, what we ate as kids.
Yeah, I think that food is always sneaks its way in and becomes like a very like prominent thing or prominent motif in like a lot of my stories. And I think with Vietnamese culture, food equals love. So there's the very stereotypical joke that my generation says that like your parents never say, your older stubborn Vietnamese parents will never ever say I love you or I'm sorry. But what they'll do is that they'll cut you some fruit and they'll pass it through the door after you had an argument, right? That's their way of saying it. So food becomes this it's a way to say, it's a way to show and say I love you without actually saying the words. And there's a lot of moments where they're making tamales together. One of my favorite scenes in the book is when Gary actually goes into the kitchen and makes her a very simple Vietnamese soup by using the very minimal ingredients that he has left. And to make someone food is a way to say I love you. And that's one of my favorite scenes in the
book. Yeah, in a lot of cultures.
Yeah.
And we're very fortunate in Portland. There's a lot of Vietnamese food and, of course, Mexican food. So.
Yeah, Ken, I'm going to make you a list of the spots you got to hit up.
I would love that. Yeah,
get some can chua.
I do have some favorite Vietnamese restaurants. I live on the west side, so a little south of Beaverton.
Oh, there's
but I have some favorite ones.
Oh, there are so many good places. Yeah, it's way more options than I remember when I was a kid. So I'm so glad to be back and to get a chance to explore it.
Now, I don't think we're given the location of the story in the book, but there's mountains, cactus, and palm trees, so it's not Oregon. Were you thinking Southern California? And I wonder why you chose not to make the location a little bit more specific.
It was intentional. So, I mean, yeah, you kind of have a vague idea. Like, what exactly you call that? You call it some palm trees, some cactus, right? It's a little bit, but I wanted to make it so a kid reading this could imagine themselves as their own town. I wanted them to, you know, I wanted them to be able to be like, okay, this could be anyone. This could be anywhere. These are,
right.
You know, this could, so I really didn't, I really didn't nail down exactly a specific place, but yeah, there are hints. Like there are, like I said, I took a lot of inspiration from the country clubs that, or the athletic clubs that I was a guest of occasionally in the Northwest.
Cause I know one of those, my sister and her family live in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
I belong to a gym here called Crunch.
Yeah.
Just $9.99 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't expect much in terms of the demographic, like me. But she belongs to a place, I don't know the real name, the technical name, but she just calls it the club.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly like this club, with the free toiletries in the locker room. They have free coffee, really good coffee. They have places where people sit, read the paper. They could order food. And occasionally they exercise. I guess that's the idea. So I totally got it.
That's exactly it. And it's funny that she mentions that she only refers to this as the club.
The club.
Because that's when I was a kid. That was the same thing. The kids that there was a club where I grew up, an athletic club, and we just all called it the club. And that's what you could only go there if you were a guest of a member. And so those kids got access to a pool and they got access to all this stuff.
This place, yes, has a pool.
And this place has a pool.
Right.
But it's funny because we
actually— Basketball court.
Basketball courts. Boy. It was like the best you could do in the summer. And the kids that didn't have it, which I was not— if I was lucky enough to go with a friend, then I could go and indulge in a day and live like a god.
That's why I went with my sister. They even have massage chairs.
Right. If you don't know about it, then you don't realize what's actually behind those doors, that gated door.
Right. I thought gyms were to exercise. Apparently not.
Yeah. And, you know, I spent a lot of my summers like Gary, which was, there was nothing to do. You're not doing anything. There was, you know, he's a latchkey kid, which was like a latchkey kid, right? Your parents, you're left to your own devices. You're wearing your key around your neck and you're left alone to do what you want. That's what a lot of my summers were like, was just, you're going to go out and do stuff. And there wasn't a lot to do. You could ride your bike around there's not much to do.
It could stimulate the imagination, like I think it has in your case.
Probably. But that, like, but then if you were lucky enough, you got that coveted invite to be a plus one for a club. You can go, you know, cool off in a pool somewhere, versus like hooking up a leaky hose to a lawn sprinkler.
I know. Now, one last question, Brandon. Your work is geared to middle grade and young adult audiences. Do you have any plans or maybe inclinations to write for a more general audience, older audience?
If the opportunity comes up,
That's right.
You got to follow that money.
Follow the money.
But I would of course say yes. It would be a challenge for me because I do like writing in the kids' space. As I mentioned before, like I don't think I love. It's an honor and a privilege to write for children. I think you don't love. There are some fantastic, amazing, incredible works of adult fiction, but I don't think you love a book as much or a story or a character as much as when you were a kid.
Like, again, you're at that age when you mention you're at an age where you just take things a little bit more dramatically, seriously.
I find that when you ask someone what their favorite book is, they will tell you, "Oh yeah, I'm reading this or I've read this," and they can. But when you ask them, "Oh, what was your favorite book when you were a kid?"
Like My House Spacesuit Will Travel. Yes, I still remember it.
Their spine straightens up. Their eyes light up. There's that sparkle. And they will love to tell you what their favorite children's book was.
Yes.
So I think there is something a little bit, you know, there's that little bit of that oomph that comes from children's books. So, I mean, to be someone's favorite book and for a kid to mention one of my books as their favorites, if that brings out a gleam in their eye, that would be that'd be a dream of mine to be that kid's book. So I do love writing for kids in that space. So,
well, Brandon, thanks so much for talking with us today. Reading your book made me feel like a young adult again.
Well, thanks for having me, Kent. This is wonderful. I'm glad.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Brandon Wong, author of the YA novel Gloria Benrostro Is Not My Girlfriend from Macmillan Publishing. You can learn more about Brandon and all his work online at brandonwongwrites.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. We'll be preempted on Thanksgiving, November 27th, for special KBOO programming, so tune in for our next show on Thursday, December 11th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,